Hello and welcome to Profiles on WFIU. I'm Peter Noble-Kachera, WFIU's film critic, and today I'm going to give a little bit of a long-winded introduction here. We'll be speaking with Dr. James Naramore. He is Emeritus Chancellor's Professor of Communications and Culture and English at Indiana University. He's taught film courses at IU and other schools for more than 30 years. He lectures widely and has a number of books, among them Acting in the Cinema, and a brand new book on Kubrick, and a book called Film Noir and Its Contexts, More Than Night, which is taught all over the country. It's sort of one of the Bibles on film noir. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Peter. It's an honor to be here.
Today, a sort of counter-programming to the Oscars, we're going to be talking about the year in movies 2007, and hopefully we'll talk about it in a little bit different way from the Oscars. We won't be going through categories, et cetera, but hopefully we'll talk about some films that folks haven't seen or heard of.
Yeah, sounds fun to me and might be interesting. We'll see.
All right. We'll try. So having read your noir book, which was an eye-opener to me, I thought noir was strictly an American genre, but I guess there were antecedents in France?
Well, actually, the word is French, of course, French film noir, and the French used that word long before Americans did, before Americans even heard of the word. And they were using it largely in regard to American movies that came out right after World War II, a kind of cycle of hard-boiled thrillers. But they already had what they called the film noir in France. In fact, one of the earliest essays they wrote about it was called, "Oh, the Americans also make film noir." Mm-hmm. And those kind of Le Jour se lève, the Jean Gabin movie, the kind of social realist thrillers, sometimes called poetic realist ones in France, those were called film noir. And in fact, virtually every industrialized country in the world makes films of this kind. So while the beating heart of the phenomenon is in Hollywood, simply because it's the world leader in the entertainment industry, still film noir is everywhere.
Were these sort of the films that were among those you were watching when you were growing up? Did they sort of help form your sensibility and your interest in movies?
Yeah, definitely. I was a mad movie maniac as a kid and spent a lot of time slouching in dark movie theaters and was really fascinated with these old black and white thrillers. So they had an important moment for me.
A lot of times when people think of noir, they think of those movies from the 40s and 50s, and sometimes with nostalgia, sometimes even with condescension. You mentioned in your book how class is watching even Double Indemnity, one of the core classics, will laugh at it now. But do you think noir still has a sort of impact today? In other words, has the form stuck around, and did it affect 2007 at all?
Yeah, let me get the last point first. There are a lot of movies, an unusually large number of movies this year, in fact, I would say, that that could be called noir. My definition of film noir is anything anybody calls a film noir.
Right.
I don't think you can come up with a set of attributes that will perfectly describe every film that's ever been called a film noir. Everybody agrees Double Indemnity is one, and there are two or three others that everybody would agree with, but it tends to branch out into a kind of a web of relationships among films. But Sidney Lumet's movie, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which was made this year, I think could be called a film noir. Gone Baby Gone, Ben Affleck's movie, could be called a film noir.
Maybe Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises, definitely. Possibly Michael Clayton. I don't know. But anyway, you see what I mean. These films that are kind of about a more or less criminal dark world and take a somewhat cynical view, I think can all be called film noir.
It was interesting to see Gone Baby Gone, based on a Dennis Lehane book, as was Mystic River, which Clint Eastwood directed.
Right.
And Eastwood starred in a number of what I would call noirs in the 70s,
yep.
Whether it's the Dirty Harry films or Play Misty for Me.
Right.
And I think that he carried that sensibility forward as a director, both as a very noirish Western, which you mentioned in your book,
right.
Unforgiven. And I think that his style had something to do with Gone Baby Gone. Obviously, it was Ben Affleck found his own form because he grew up there, and
right.
but I think that Eastwood shadows the film.
Well, remember also that Eastwood served his apprenticeship with Don Siegel, a longtime Hollywood director and a director who's associated with the film noir, made several fairly important film noirs at the B-movie level. So continued to make really good noirish movies into the 70s. I've always liked Charlie Varick very much. But anyway, yeah, that's where Eastwood went to school there, in effect, with a director who had that kind of sensibility. Yeah.
I have your top 10 list, and they're in no particular order, you tell me, except for the first three, which are in order. And I'm looking at all three, and I haven't heard of them. They didn't even come to Indianapolis. And I was wondering if you could sort of talk about some of those films in your top three, and also about how – I know you have an apartment in Chicago, so you have some access mm-hmm. to big city mm-hmm. movies, mm-hmm. But how people might be able to see them.
Yeah. Before we start, let me back up a bit and put this in context.
Sure.
We're going to start naming some films that I thought were important this year. This came about as a result of an assignment, a writing assignment I accepted for a journal. And I've never really tried to do this kind of thing before, name what I thought were the 10 best films of the year. And when I set about doing it, I was immediately confronted with a couple of practical problems that I hadn't thought about before. One of these is that not me, not you, not anybody who even writes with a daily assignment for the newspaper, not even Roger Ebert, can possibly see all the films released in the United States in a given year.
That's right.
So that's one practical problem. And so for me, there were some films that I missed. I didn't get to see Persepolis, for example, mm-hmm. which I know is a film you admire.
Yeah, it's in my top 10.
Yeah. But I think that's going to happen with any of us. I'm going to name some films that you haven't seen and so forth. The other problem is, how do you date? What is a 2007 film?
What are your dividing lines?
Yeah. What I try to do to limit myself, since there are films that are made that go direct to video and so forth, I limited myself to films that, as best as I could reckon, got their first theatrical U.S. screening in 2007, regardless of when the film was made. So in other words, an older film that had never been shown in the United States would count for me.
So for example, I hope we're going to talk a little bit about Black Book, which is a movie
yes.
that some people would think of as a 2006
yes.
film, but we're going to say that's okay to talk about.
I'm going to claim that as a 2007 film, yes. And there are a lot of films that fall on the margin like this. For example, Donnersmarck's film The Lives of Others appeared in several 2007 best lists among U.S. critics this year. But by my accounting, that belongs in 2006. Mm-hmm. And in any case, my point is that it's always somewhat arbitrary. There are always these films on the margin. So you take the best shot at it you can, and nobody can be precisely accurate about these things. So, okay, those are my two qualifiers. Now, my 10 best list was composed of films that I saw this year, and one television series that was new, the first time appearing in the U.S. this year. And I realized when I made up this list that several of the films, probably nobody who's listening to us today has seen. Maybe there might be a wild chance that somebody has seen one of them. But they were the most remarkable films I saw, the first three this year. And they got no distribution in Bloomington, and they're probably never going to get any distribution in Bloomington. That's because in Bloomington, all the theater screens are managed by sort of corporate interests that only want to book those things that are advertised most by the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And Hollywood is now kind of vertically and horizontally integrated. And it really,
much more so than they were vertically integrated before they were broken up. It's
exactly.
Even worse now, if I can say
exactly.
worse.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So they have a lock on the system right now. And they've figured out a way to spend almost more money marketing films than they do making films. And they wind up with a little profit with this system. But we're getting a fairly uninteresting product from Hollywood, and in Bloomington is particularly in a bad situation that way. Now, I hope it won't always be that way, but the only way we can get around that would be to build a Cinematheque in Bloomington, which I hope someday we'll do. But in any case,
one thing that's sort of developed over the last two or three years in Bloomington is that Carasotis, which shut down the Von Lee and refused to sell the property with a non-competition clause to any other movie theater. Anyway, they've sort of figured out now that they can make money on quote unquote art films, and so they they do reserve a few screens over at Showplace East, the more the less fancy place,
right.
For what we might consider independent or art films. But the ones that we're going to get here, they arrive without fanfare. They sort of miss the wave, so we don't know they're here. You really have to keep checking. And they're pretty much the ones that are going to be nominated or did get a nomination for an Oscar.
Yes.
So much we're not seeing.
Yeah. And Karasotis, of course, because it has a monopoly, doesn't need to advertise.
That's right.
And so there, people who live here locally have no idea what these films are unless you really keep up with movies. You're not likely to recognize them. But even at that, their programming is rather arbitrary and conservative. I can't figure out what might wind up here or not. By the way, let me just say that one of the films that falls on the margin for me here this year, what, 4 months?
3 weeks.
Three weeks and 2 days, which you and I have both seen. And for you, that counts as this year's film. For me, I'm going to hold it off.
I'll stick to your criteria.
Yeah.
It's painful, though, because
it's a great film.
Oh, boy, I want to talk about that.
Yeah.
You should just see it, period. It's that good.
Well, let's hope it will come to Bloomington. So, okay, where were we? Okay, we're going to talk about the films I enjoyed.
Can I read the first one on your list, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, yes.
The film is Colossal Youth by Pedro Costa. Tell us about that one.
This is by far, for me, the most important and significant film I saw this year. It's only played in a few places in the United States, largely with a kind of traveling retrospective of Pedro Costa's work that, you know, it played in the big cities, New York, Chicago, maybe San Francisco and L.A., few museum venues. Pedro Costa is a Portuguese director, and for the past almost decade, he's been working in an area of Lisbon called the Fontenhas area of Lisbon, which is the poorest place in Lisbon. It's largely a place of black folks who came to Portugal as workers from the Cape Verdean Islands. In any case, Costa has gone there. He made the Colossal Youth, the one that I'm so impressed by, is the third in a trilogy of films he made there. The first is called Bones, and it's about a desperately poor teenage couple and their baby. Another one, the second one, is called In Vanda's Room, and it's about a woman named Vanda Duarte, who is a drug addict, and virtually the whole film takes place in this single room where Vanda shoots up and talks to her friends and so forth. And then this third one is Colossal Youth. Vanda is also in Colossal Youth, but it shifts to a male character named Ventura. I should explain that all the actors in the film are actual residents of Fontenhas. They are making up their own stories, in effect, for the films. Like a lot of great films and also a lot of really bad ones, Costa's films blur the line between a documentary and fiction. These films were shot under the lowest production levels you could imagine. They were shot with a digital camera, no lighting equipment, sometimes without even electricity, the very simplest sound, and without a crew. Costa spent lots of time making them, sometimes 40 or 50 shots, per scene. But the effect is really marvelous. One of the amazing qualities of these films is that Costa works completely against the grain of neorealism. We're accustomed to this kind of film, calling this kind of film neorealistic. That is, it has non-professional actors. It's kind of shot, kind of handheld, and it's in a real place and so forth. And it's about kind of social problems.
But in neorealism, you would also expect long takes.
Yes, and you do get them in this film.
Unobtrusive camera, not a lot of editing.
Yeah. What's remarkable about this film, though, is its sort of almost painterly quality. It's one of the most, for me, one of the most beautiful films I've seen this year. Every shot change just knocks me out. One of the most remarkable ones comes when suddenly we wind up in the Gulbenkian Museum in Lisbon and see a Rubens over in the corner, just sort of glowing in the corner. It seems to have come out of nowhere. The film is mysterious, elliptical. It forces you to kind of find your way around. It doesn't have anything overtly dramatic, and a lot of people wouldn't like it for that reason. It's composed almost entirely of sequence shots with an unmoving camera, very austerely and carefully composed. There's nothing sensational about the movie. The actors are kind of stately, and they're created. They're presented with great discretion. I don't know where to start with this film. I love this movie.
It's hard to stop,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Costa was a great revelation to me. I'd never seen any of his work before, and I would rank him with, you know, the great directors of all time.
And that film, if you want to start with that one again, is Colossal Youth. And what's your second film of the
Well,
year?
The second film is, again, a kind of unusual one. This film was made in 1970, so it winds up on my 2007 film list, but it was never shown in America. It's a movie called, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, it's by a Catalan director, a Spanish Catalan director, named Per Portabella, spelled just like the portobello mushroom. And the film is called Cow de Cook Vampire. Cow de Cook is apparently a pun. It can refer to a worm, and it also refers to the unexposed footage left on a film reel when you've been shooting a film reel. So this is called Cow de Cook Vampire. Per Portabella, his career goes back pretty far. He was the producer in 1961 of Buñuel's Viridiana. He was an anti-Franco fellow, and as you may know about Viridiana, Franco got very upset about Viridiana, and as a result, Portabella's films, he started making avant-garde films around the 1970s. They weren't allowed to be shown in Spain. They were shown only clandestinely, and they didn't get very far outside of Spain either. This is a pretty much non-narrative avant-garde director who's made a few films. And this one just fascinated me. What this film is that Portabella has a 35-millimeter widescreen black and white format that he's working in. He goes to the set. So what was happening in 1970 is that a director named Jess Franco, who was working for a European combine, was making a movie called Count Dracula in Spain, starring Christopher Lee and Herbert Lom. And I don't know if you have seen those kind of color widescreen late cycle of horror movies that began at Hammer Films in Britain and then kind of spun out and were used.
Yeah, I've seen the Hammer Films. I love them.
Well, the Hammer Films are really good. And Count Dracula is not a bad film either. It's a kind of a Euro-trashy film of the moment. But in any case, what Portabella did was he went to the set and he photographed them as they're making the film. So what we get is a kind of a bizarre making-of documentary. But shot in a different format. Sometimes his camera is right in there with the actors. In fact, perhaps most of the time. So it's as if he is shooting his own film alongside Jess Franco's film. Sometimes he gets back in the background and we see the crew at work. We glimpse the camera. We see guys spinning artificial cobwebs around the walls or you know, driving a fake stake through a woman's heart or something like that. We see spirit gum on somebody's wig, or we see little strings holding a bat up. All those things are visible. But what Portabella has done is he manipulates his footage. He I guess it's what they call flashing, so that it has a kind of a blurry, sometimes overexposed or underexposed look. And his film is a truly eerie, spooky film. It has the quality of Dreyer's Vampyr or Murnau's Nosferatu, those kind of old, really haunted, uncanny Dracula movies. It almost has a vampirish relationship to the film it's photographing. It takes this kind of almost erotic delight in seizing on that film. It doesn't condescend to that film, but it transforms it into this cadaverous, a really interesting visual thing we're looking at. It also, I think, is probably, though it's hard to see this, it's significant that the film he's vampiring on was directed by a man named Franco, Jess Franco. And so that there is, I think, probably some kind of subtle allegory about a blood-sucking Spanish dictatorship in it. But by the way, I should also say that the film is silent. So that the other eerie thing about it is the actors move their lips and you don't hear them.
Are there intertitles between?
No intertitles, but what you get is this sort of avant-garde soundtrack that consists of sort of semi-kitschy light jazz and jackhammers and wind, like a jet plane taking off, thumping, bizarre sounds. And this adds also to the eeriness and strangeness of the film. Visually, it was one of the most gorgeous things I saw all year.
This may be a facile comparison, but how does it compare to the film that came out a few years ago about Murnau making Nosferatu with, I think, Malkovich, and the vampire is an actual vampire? I mean, It just doesn't compare, huh?
It doesn't. That was an awful film. I thought it was almost sacrilege. The film was so bad because Moore now is such a great director. I thought the film was silly. What it would compare to, some people may have seen Guy Madden's film called Dracula, Pages from a Virgin's Diary, which was a ballet adaptation of Bram Stoker's novel and shot in Guy Madden's style. And his films have that look of an old decaying movie. And that sort of haunted look that those old movies have.
Yeah. I have some Guy Madden movies at home on your recommendation from Netflix, and I had hoped to see them before we talked today. But he's a director that you've pointed me to. He's a Canadian director, and there's another name to write down on a piece of paper and check out his films as well.
Yeah.
The third film, Bamako. Am I saying that
Bamako?
Right? Bamako.
Yeah, Bamako is the capital city of Mali. This is a film. I'm not even sure I know how to pronounce the director's name. His name is Abderrahmane Sissoko, Sissako. He was born in Mali. He was born in Africa, but he got his education in Europe and I think in the Soviet Union. He went to film school. He's basically centered in France right now. This is a movie that takes place – again, this is my number three movie. This movie takes place in a small square – in a poor quarter in Bamako, the capital of Mali, where the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are being put on trial. There are lawyers there from France and Europe representing these things, and then there are witnesses called before an African court to do their side of the story, and it becomes a quite elaborate and fascinating discussion of economic European and U.S. economic policy vis-a-vis Africa. Bamako becomes a little microcosm of the nation and of Africa as a whole and of a part of Africa that has really never had a chance to represent itself on film. This film kind of lays bare International Monetary Fund policy and how it's affected the lives of Africans. What we see around the square as the trial is going on is the daily life around the square. We can see women dyeing these kind of gorgeously colored textiles, and we can see people going off on their daily rounds. There's a beautiful woman who comes out of one of the rooms and all the men stare at her, and we follow her to her job where she's singing in a cabaret and having to kind of endure the embraces of some kind of smarmy guy in a suit, while her husband is unemployed like most of the males, and his life ends tragically. Anyway, the dramatic parts of the film are not very effective, but the trial itself is fascinating, and the film is beautiful in representing that trial. Sometimes something amusing will happen. One of the French lawyers goes off and tries to talk on a cell phone with his constituents, and a goat almost butts him as he's talking on the phone. It's sort of like – I don't know how to explain it. It's not a realistic film, obviously. It's a little bit like Jean-Luc Godard, if Godard had a gentler sense of humor and a more lucid politics. I love the film.
It's interesting, the sort of jarring effect of someone on a cell phone being butted by a goat reminds me of the African film which was released here a couple of years ago, Mulade, by the great African director who's now died, Ousmane Simbin.
Yes.
And there were scenes like that in that film as well, which is next to this sort of earthy mosque that looks like an anthill that had grown out of the ground. There's a pile of televisions that are being burned or these little pieces of modernity that work their way into this village.
Right. I should say that he also in describing this film – every now and then we cut away from the trial, and at one point we cut away and we see lines of African men trying to get out of Africa to find employment in Europe, just kind of struggling across the desert. At one point we cut into a house and we see some kids gathered around an old television set, and they're watching a Western on TV, but it's a parody of an American Western. It stars Danny Glover, who was one of the producers of this film, and it's about these bad cowboys who ride into town and start killing off all the teachers in town. It's a kind of comic reference to the fact that it's not a realistic film at all, but it's a kind of comic reference to the fact that these what were called structural economic adjustments have been imposed on Africa in order to get them to balance their budgets. And as a result, the people are less educated. The health rates have gone down. It's been disastrous, these kind of neoliberal economic plans for Africa, and that's what the film is indicting.
The film is Bamako and
Bamako. I think it's Bamako.
I just can't get that right.
Yeah, it's all right. You may be right.
Just as a tangent, I found it interesting a couple years ago. I don't know if you noticed this, or maybe it was really last year. There were a spate of Hollywood films about Africa, sort of kicked off with The Constant Gardener, and then there was Lord of War and Blood Diamond.
Right.
And my feeling about that was that it was sort of – this is a little out there, but I do believe it – that it was sort of misplaced guilt for the mess we made in Iraq. It just it felt like Africa was easier to talk about than Iraq.
Yeah.
And we're going to take a break in just a minute. And when we come back, I can ask you about this year's Iraq films. There were just a ton of them coming out of Hollywood. But I did want you to just briefly explain how people could get a chance to see these movies if they live in Bloomington or elsewhere in Indiana, not going to make it to Chicago to catch the new screenings. What do you need in order to track these down?
First of all, you need to know about them. Somebody needs to mention their names,
just as I've done. Where do you go
and,
to raise awareness?
Right now, you're not going to be able to get either Colossal Youth or Kaudekick Vampire. As far as I know, I think Colossal Youth will be available next year or several months from now in a European DVD.
So
in order to watch it, you need to purchase what's called an all-region DVD player, and those are not expensive at all. I think you can get them for as cheap as $75, but for $120, you can get a really good one. And they simply allow you to be able to watch movies from other countries.
And you would find one of these online, right? You're not going
to have
to
go online. You'd have to go to Amazon or to my copy of Bamako, which I think may be coming out on a U.S. DVD. I don't know, but I purchased my a DVD copy of Bamako from Amazon UK. It's been out for about a year there, and it's a terrific DVD.
And there's just a proliferation of films coming out of Africa, coming out of India.
Exactly.
And just one last thing before our break. How do you raise your awareness of international cinema? Where do you even go to find out about the movies that you should
see? Unfortunately, you have to work at it. I mean, this is limited to people with some income and education, I suppose. You have to go because the society itself doesn't give you a chance to look at these things. You have to read movie reviews in places like the New York Times, or you have to maybe go online and look. For example, there's an online film magazine called Senses of Cinema, which comes out of Australia.
Senses of Cinema.
Yeah, it's if you just write Senses of Cinema in Google, you can find their address. And at the end of this year, they polled internationally all over the world what everybody's top 10 list was. You could look at that.
Oh, that's a great resource.
Yeah. Anyway, you have to search for it.
That is, I think, the nature of international cinema right now is that for all of it, you have to go looking. Jonathan Rosenbaum, who I know you and I both admire, mm-hmm. He's a critic for the Chicago Reader, wrote a book that was published last year called Movie Wars, mm-hmm. How Hollywood Limits the Movies You Can mm-hmm. See. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrific book, but he explains at length why we're just locked out of this stuff. And it's not an accident. It is intentional.
Exactly.
And it's not our fault. The sort of myth is that American moviegoers are stupid.
They don't like movies.
Movies that make them think or that are subtitled.
Yeah, exactly.
And none of it's true. None of it's true. I mean, it's a myth perpetuated for specific business reasons by Hollywood. And, if you haven't seen a lot of subtitled films, it's not your fault. But I can guarantee you don't avoid films because they're subtitled. Within 10 minutes, you will have forgotten about the subtitles in a film.
Yes. Yeah.
So, well, let's take a musical break for a minute. We're going to hear a clip from a score by a composer who I greatly admire, Howard Shore. It's a piece from the soundtrack to Eastern Promises.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Profiles on WFIU. I'm Peter Noble Kachera, WFIU's film critic, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jim Naramore, Emeritus Chancellor's Professor of Communications and Culture and English at Indiana University. Having listened to that clip from the Eastern Promises soundtrack, it's a very yearning piece. It seems to suggest the movie's sadness, specifically Russian sadness, which I thought was so interesting. It's such a secretive movie. I'm interested in what you thought of that movie, how good you think it is. I know you said it's been growing on you. And specifically, how whether you think it's better or as good as A History of Violence, which was such a high point for Cronenberg.
Yeah. I actually like it better than History of Violence. I am probably in a great minority in that regard. For some reason, History of Violence, perhaps because it was based on a graphic novel, seemed a little too comic booky for me. And I couldn't believe the small town in that film.
Yeah, I don't think you're supposed to in that it's hyper real. It's way too clean.
Yeah.
There's way too much bonhomie.
Yeah.
They're too friendly.
Yeah, yeah. So I just probably wasn't tuned into that film correctly. Eastern Promises, I like a good deal. It, I think, is atmospherically, as a piece of photography and music and acting and so forth, really a terrific movie. It's not one of my top 10 films. And in fact, I don't, as a noir film, I don't like it as much as I like Gone Baby Gone. And I think it's technically a better movie than Gone Baby Gone, better shot, more lucidly told, more interesting in that way. But Gone Baby Gone is simply fascinating to me because of its depiction of a milieu, and also because it has that splendid moral irony at the end of it. Whereas I think Eastern Promises is more like a straightforward melodrama, you know. And in any case, it's a good melodrama.
It is, and I do have the feeling I watched it again for the second time that it may have secrets that it doesn't yield up. For instance, I'm not sure we ever really get to know what makes the Viggo Mortensen character tick. I think without ruining the film, there's a possibility that he has engineered things all the way so that he ends up where he does at the end of the film. But one film that is on both of our lists is Black Book, and maybe you could describe that a little bit for people who haven't seen it.
Yeah, Black Book is a film made by Paul Verhoeven, who had a Hollywood career. He's well known for
Total Recall, Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers.
Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct, RoboCop. Anyway, he was originally a Dutch director, made some films in Europe before coming to Hollywood, and now he's gone back to Holland where he just made this movie, Black Book. Black Book is, how shall I describe it? It's a really old school piece of adventure filmmaking.
It is.
It has a heroine at the center of it, a spirited young Jewish cabaret singer in World War II who's hiding out from the Nazis in Nazi-occupied Holland. She winds up in The Hague where she joins the resistance or the underground, and they assign her to have an affair with the head of the Gestapo in The Hague. She does this, and we just sort of careen from one hairbreadth escape to another and so forth. She's a sort of combination of Mata Hari, Marlena Dietrich, and Pearl White. I don't know. The film just goes—
That's a great description.
Yeah, it just doesn't let up. The hairbreadth escapes are almost on the point of absurdity. However, it's a wonderfully entertaining film. It, too, has a sort of Bernard Herrmann-esque music score by somebody named Ann Dudley. I think it's so entertaining that people might not recognize its underlying seriousness. And that's true with a lot of Verhoeven movies.
He lived through Nazi occupation.
Exactly.
He had friends who were lined up against the wall and shot in front of him.
Exactly. And this movie, in fact, however improbable you might think it is actually made from verifiable incidents that happened in the last year of World War II. Several interesting things about the movie. One is that it's a movie that keeps you off balance a little bit. For example, the Dutch Calvinists who shelter the young Jewish woman at the beginning of the film force her to recite lines from the New Testament in order to be fed. And then there's a sort of a Christian member of the underground who's a psycho killer. And the Gestapo guy that she has an affair with turns out to be a nice guy. So we keep blurring the boundaries that we normally think of, and I think the film just does an excellent job of that. By the way, it also points toward the present day because the Nazis, they practice waterboarding. Mm-hmm. And on the DVD, Verhoeven is really quite good at commenting on that. By the way, waterboarding was on the minds of several filmmakers this year.
Is that right?
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest blockbuster films, which we've all seen, is The Bourne Ultimatum. And it turns out
– They do that to him. Yeah.
Yes. It turns out that Jason Bourne lost his identity or lost his memory because he was waterboarded by a sort of Dick Cheney type at the Central Intelligence Agency or whatever it is. So anyway, I think that's been on the minds of Americans a lot this year. Hmm. Yeah.
I think what I responded to so much in Black Book and in a lot – in most of Verhoeven's work wasn't so much the underlying seriousness, which I totally agree is there, but how overcooked it is. I loved the melodrama. I loved the cinematography, which is incredibly bright and sharp and colorful.
Yeah.
And it is a ripping yarn. It just goes from one situation to the next.
Yeah.
And I loved it in that way.
Yeah. Let me just say also about the photography. One of the things that I like about the movie is, in keeping with the period perhaps, Verhoeven, who's used plenty of digital special effects in the past.
In the past. He does not
in this movie. There are one or two minor digital effects in the film. I'm not against the digital. I think it's opened up new avenues and everything in film. But I think one practice that I really don't like is that kind of shellacked look that a lot of films, that very glossy look that a lot of films have today. And it's because the actresses' faces are being digitally enhanced and so forth. And
cinematography is being done in the computer.
Yeah. And everything looks kind of plastic to me. And whereas this film, it just looks good. I like everything about it.
You know, one of the films that's on your top 10 is takes computer graphics to its extreme, which is it's an animated film, Ratatouille. Many people have probably seen it.
Yeah.
It is completely freewheeling about its use of computer-generated images, but it's so beautiful to look at.
Yeah, yeah. I know you don't admire Ratatouille as much as I do. It's one of my top 10 films.
Though only at the screenplay level, and I quibble with the voice acting choices of the rat and Linguini.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's just gorgeous to look at.
Yeah. I like the screenplay. Let me just say this because it teaches this kind of lesson that talent can come from anywhere.
Yeah.
Not everybody can be talented, but talent can come from everywhere. Although talent has to overcome sometimes objections of one's own family. Also, the film takes place in this it's a lovely Valentine to Paris, but also a little bit of a satire. It takes place in the whole cuisine world of Paris, which is an all-male world, hierarchical, and Rennie the Rat, who's a terrific cook, manages to conquer that world and even melt the heart of Anton Ego, the big food critic. They nail up Gusteau's, where he's working, when they discover it's a rat's been doing this, but they all move off to this little bistro and everybody's happy there. It's a kind of a democratic world. So I don't know. To me, you could call it a middlebrow film, but it's a film that has the utopian, comic, democratic qualities of middlebrow that I think really work. So I love it. Yeah. But going back to the business about the digital, I think that if Pedro Costa's film shows what beauty you can get with a simple digital camera under kind of more or less documentary conditions, this film really shows what you can do with high-end digital animation. And for me, it almost constitutes a new art form with its own phenomenology. The
CGI animation.
Yes, yeah. In many ways, the film is sort of hyper-realistic. In the kitchen, you can see every little detail of everything. And if you look at Paris, it looks like every cobblestone is present there for you. So it imitates movies so much that often a figure standing in the foreground will be slightly out of focus.
Right.
And so it's almost it's trying to look like it's photographed, but at the same time the characters running through the film
are cartoony
and they're moving in that cartoony way. They have a caricatured kind of faces and so forth. So it's a sort of push pull between hyper realism and stylization or foregrounding the technique that I think is brilliantly used. It's a really spectacular film, and sometimes that even becomes the source of jokes. Linguini, the poor chef that Rennie is trying to help, in his little apartment, there's a little black and white TV set, and it's showing Brief Encounter. Only it's an animated version of Brief Encounter.
I wondered what that film was. I believe it or not, I haven't seen it, but I noticed that, and I wondered what it was.
Yeah. And anyway, it's a very witty and clever film, and I just loved it. Yeah.
How it satirizes Paris. I loved the moment when Remy is coming up from the sewer and he's running along, and you see these little scenes in people's apartments playing themselves out.
There's a lot of really funny jokes in the in the background in little small ways that the film is always throwing at you. Yeah.
In terms of animation, two films in my top 10 were animated, and I know that you haven't seen either of them, but I briefly want to mention them and advocate for them. Persepolis, the French film about Majid, who's a little girl growing up in the Shah's Iran, and then grows up through the changes, through the Shah being deposed by the Islamic Revolution, and she leaves because her parents are afraid of her, and comes back and finds she can't come home again. It's a wonderful story. It's a moving story. It's from an unusual point of view inside this movement that we don't really understand. Right now, I think it's important to realize that Iran is not homogenous.
Yes.
That there's a great deal of variety in political and religious views in Iran to this day.
Some of the best filmmakers in the world are coming from Iran right now.
Oh, is that right? I haven't seen any of them.
Yeah. Abbas Kiarostami, have you ever heard of him?
No, I haven't.
I would say he's one of the best filmmakers in the world. And look him up. You can get DVDs of his
I will, which is why I love talking to you. I get all these directors to follow up on.
Yeah.
In Persepolis, it's a great film. It has it's a cell animated film. It's all in black and white. They look like very sharp ink drawings. It's based on a graphic novel. If you want to get an idea of the style, it's maybe a little like Art Spiegelman's Mouse in a way, visually. But great film. And another one that that not a lot of people saw last year was a Japanese animated film, an anime film called Paprika. And it was championed by Manola Dargis of the New York Times, and they used her review in all the advertising. She made the point that while she said American animators are playing in the sandbox, Japanese animators are aiming for the stars. And I don't think she meant that to be true of Ratatouille, but certainly something like Shrek 3 or Into the Wild or some of these horrible, forgettable things, you know, surfs up. From a visual imagination standpoint, this film just had wings, and it just some of it is just pure cinema, and it's another good one to check out.
That's I got it on my list, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. Yeah.
One movie that conspicuously is absent from your movie list of top 10 and mine is There Will Be Blood. What do you think of it? Where does it rank? And what do you think?
Well, I think it's a good film. And it may be that it was so praised that I was expecting to see a combination of Greed and Citizen Kane or something. And I just didn't see that. But my expectations were so high when I went to see it. And I think maybe there was some inevitable downer in that way. It's also been called an epic. And it does have a broad historical sweep. I think it begins in 1898 and ends in 1924.
It has a lot of wide vistas.
Yes, and I think Paul Thomas Anderson, the director, has used the wide screen extremely well in that film. My idea of an epic about oil in the Southwest is giant. You know,
sure.
The old Rock Hudson, James Dean movie, because you've got a wider range of interesting characters, and I think a more specific interest in history. I didn't feel when I came away from There Will Be Blood that the film was really that much interested in history in the way Upton Sinclair would have been, for example. What I think that film is about is a psychological drama about relationships between fathers and sons, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's favorite theme. And I think we've got a really good performance by Daniel Day-Lewis, who sounds to me a lot like he's trying to imitate John Huston's voice. And you've got that really nice doppelganger or mirror image relationship between the fanatic oil man and the evangelist, you know, who are kind of locked in a death struggle. And they're both of them con men to some degree.
And Henry, his brother, again, they're doubled.
Yes. So anyway, it's an interesting film. I would say it's in my honorable mention list, but it's not in my top 10.
I feel the same way about it. I feel it's largely a showcase for the Daniel Day-Lewis performance. Mm-hmm. And that's where his focus is. I think that in this case, he set out to make – Paul Thomas Anderson set out to make a movie that would stand outside of time. Mm-hmm. He deliberately avoids anything that would date the film.
Yeah.
But I think his ambition sort of exceeded his command of technique right now. I don't think he quite has control of the medium. The dolly shots aren't smooth enough. The computer graphics for the oil spurt and for the flames.
Yeah.
They seem like quibbling points to make, but really you can't cut corners if you want to step outside of time. And so the movie dates itself.
Mm-hmm.
We're winding down and we're going to play a clip from the movie Once. And I wanted to set this up by saying Once is another movie that would have been impossible probably a few years ago before digital cameras became cheap.
Mm-hmm.
It's shot in such a way that the camera can go just about anywhere, even into very low light conditions, and I think it's really exciting that these tools are falling into the hands of directors.
Yes, it's a very low budget film. Other films I really liked besides Once are No End in Sight, Away From Her, the Sarah Pauli movie.
Oh, yeah.
And The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And the TV show that I mentioned is Mad Men, which was on American Movie Classics this year. Anyway, once. I was very taken by this movie, as a lot of people were. It's a very simple kind of neorealist film about musicians in Dublin. But it's almost like the musical numbers are worthy of MGM. There's this beautiful traveling shot for one of them that looks like a kind of neorealist Vincent Minnelli. And this song that we're going to hear, which is, serves as the sort of boy meets girl song in the movie, it has the structure of a Hollywood musical almost, is played in the back of a record shop on a grand piano and an old guitar. And it was recorded live, not by playback. It was performed live, not by playback, by two real musicians.
Who also wrote the music.
Who also wrote the music, right. And I don't know how it sounds for people who haven't seen the movie. But if you watch the movie and you see this and you aren't touched and moved by it, then you and I are never going to be intimate friends. Anyway, I love this movie. Yeah.
Before we hear the clip, that's about all we have time for, so we're going to wind down. Dr. Naremore, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm Peter Doble-Kachera, and this has been Profiles for WFIU.
The program you have just heard was recorded in February of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.